She reduces, reuses, and recycles. She talks the talk and walks the walk. She doesn't tell you what to think. She just wants you to. She's Mrs. Green. And this is Mrs. Green's World on the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network. And now, Mrs. Green.
Welcome, everybody. This is the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. And thank you so much for joining us today. Happy Mother's Day. Mother's Day is tomorrow. So happy Mother's Day to everybody out there who is a mom or a grandmom or a granddaughter. It's really a very, very special day. We've got an exciting show as usual. First up, we will have Simon Markser, who is calling in from Miraval Resort and Spa, which just opened their new spa. It's already creating a buzz around the globe. It's a game changer. Unique offerings. I mean, I'm hearing some of the things that Michael Tompkins described last week, and I was like, whoa. Could we have a visual for that? So that's very exciting. And our second guest is acclaimed author William DuBois, who'll be talking with us about his most recent book. It's called A Great Aridness, Climate Change, and the Future of the American Southwest. So we're pretty excited about that, too. I had the privilege of hearing Bill speak at the Tucson Festival of Books, so that is something I'm really looking forward to. And now I have a couple of really quick announcements. We're doing something really fun with Golden Eagle Distributors. They're one of our supporters, and they're doing something neat with Budweiser for World Environment Day. And, of course, Mrs. Green loves anything that's fun with Green and Mrs. Green. You got to love it. So it's Grow One, Save a Million campaign. And the average guy uses 5 gallons of water every time he shaves. So they're asking men around the country to grow a beard and save a million gallons of water. Guys, seriously, even if you don't want to grow a beard, just put some hot water in the sink and make it happen. Don't use 5 gallons of water. They actually said it's 3 to 10. So close it and, you know, just get over the have the water running. Don't do that. You can check it out on Golden Eagle's Facebook page or on Bud's Grow One Facebook page. And I did it a couple of days ago, and it really cracks me up. So don't forget about that. And it's fun, and I can't participate. So I wish you'd let me know if you're going to. And another quick one. Please don't forget to listen to me every Saturday live at 12 at MrsGreensWorld.com. Just like to remind you that you can listen on your iPhone or Droid. And if you do have to miss because you're busy at Saturday at noon, which many people are, please remember that the podcasts of all my shows live on my website right there for your listening pleasure. And don't forget to connect with me on Facebook, Twitter, or email me info@MrsGreensWorld.com if you have questions. So we're going to have a great show. If you just tuned in a minute or two late, our first guest is Simon Markser, calling in from Miraval, and we are going to start with him. I think we might be having a little bit of technical difficulties, which it's a real world, and that's what happens. So, Simon, can you hear me?
Yeah, I sure can, and good morning.
Good morning. I'm glad you're here from Miraval Resort and Spas, my heaven on earth.
Oh, great. Well, I'm glad to be here. It's such a pleasure, and happy early Mother's Day to you this morning.
Thank you. Thank you. It's such a special day. So how has your life been the last couple of years?
Well, it's been busy. It's been busy, but I'm starting the day feeling so good about myself because I use an electric razor, and I didn't realize how much I was helping the planet every morning when I shave with my electric razor.
They said, really, in the article I read, it did say that it was 10 gallons, really more than like 10 gallons. And, like, you can't do that anymore, especially when you're having Bill DuBois on next talking about America, that we're running out of water really fast.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, and hopefully our new spa will be a big part of the future of the American Southwest. So maybe we can get Bill out here as well.
I know, that'd be great. He's really, actually, he's amazing. I mean, he's written 7 books. Right there, I'm like, you've got me. And he's done some unbelievable things. He's really smart. He's really funny. And his name is spelled D-U-B-U-Y-S. So I was calling him Dubois, and he said, it's Dubois. And I said, okay, like, close the door so Dubois doesn't come in. That's how corny I can be, Simon.
That's all right. That's all pretty good. I'm just impressed they got marks there. So let's talk about their new spa, because I know you're going to come out. This next weekend is going to be great. We're going to have our grand opening.
I'm so excited. I can't stand it. So
wonderful,
Do you want to start a little bit about the concept?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, when we began the process, it was really paramount for us to have a design that really reflected the Southwest, our surroundings and our environment, because when people come to a spa, especially a spa like Miraval, they want to have that connection to the environment that they're in. And so it was really paramount that we captured that a very sort of indigenous environment with our new design, and working with our designer Cloda and our architects Mathun out of Seattle. They really, really worked hard to sort of bring the outside in and capture that sort of Southwest feel, but very earthy, very natural feel in our design. And I think they just were wonderfully successful. So far, the feedback has been really great, and I look forward to hearing what you think when you come this next weekend.
Everybody in the world will be hearing about it.
Right.
Mrs. Great. Green will be tweeting, Facebooking, and telling all her friends all around the country. So
wonderful.
When you incorporate it, just give a little bit of visual for radio listeners about, give one example of what you mean incorporating the outside and the rugged terrain with the spa experience. Because I get it, but it's paint a little bit of a picture if you can.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think when the arrival to the spa, it's one of the things that really, it sets the tone for the spa experience. And so one of the things that we really focused on was what sort of, as you arrive, what did we want to have that would be sort of visually reflect what we want your experience to be? And one of the things that we did was we set up a stone cairn display area. So when folks walk in, there's a large series of stones, and one can sort of set an intention for their spa experience and build a little stone cairn. We have them all over the property, these wonderful sort of magical little stacked stones that really reflect an intention one sets for their spa experience.
And you do stop and give pause on the property. When I'm out there, I stop and I say, wow, this, and it makes you very mindful.
Yeah, it really does. And it sort of brings your focus from sort of the outside world within. And that's a huge part of the spa experience, really bringing your focus and being mindful and being present, which is, as you know well, it's a fundamental theme of Miraval as a whole, but certainly a theme of the spa experience. I really wanted to have something that reflected that and sort of brought you to that place prior to arriving the spa. So there's this beautiful cairn stacking before you walk in. The stucco walls of the spa have this beautiful kind of sort of mesquite bark tone blending into the desert well.
Right.
And that's one of the priorities, obviously, that looks like it belongs in the surroundings.
Right, and when you describe it, I start relaxing.
Yeah, and we haven't even gotten through the front door.
There you go. I'm like, okay, I'm going.
Yes, it's, and you know, and once you get through the door, it's just a staggering view. We have entirely glass walls that essentially look from what we call our quiet room, which is where you relax for pre-treatment or after your treatment, and have a view of the Catalina Mountains. We have a fireplace that's a gas burning fireplace, but the quiet room area is really one of our signature spaces, where you look out in the Catalina Mountains, and it's just absolutely stunning. So people can come, and I think that's one of the first things they notice. The feel in the lobby is very rich and earthy. We have a fallen cedar tree that was harvested, but one long plank for the front desk, which is just absolutely beautiful. Yes,
okay.
Yes.
Wow, and, that's going to be great.
It is. It is. And I think that one of the other features that I think you'll really enjoy, which really does reflect in terms of design, the intention of sort of focusing within and being present, is a space that we call a sort of our portal. It's the transition from our lobby into our treatment area. It's lined with a reclaimed barn wood. It's just beautiful, beautiful texture, beautiful color. And essentially what we wanted to do is to sort of create a space that signified a break of the intention of each space. So you pass through the lobby area, which can be social, and at our busy times, you can have a lot of folks and a lot of energy in the front lobby area. And then the energy changes as you pass through the portal area, and our focus sort of goes within.
I know it sounds a little ridiculous, but that's so intentional. And having gone to many spas, you're right, it's kind of frenetic out in the front. Yeah. You know, everybody's coming in, checking in, find out where they go. So you have a portal, actually, that you pass through to begin that relaxing, which so we also need. So go ahead.
Right. And well, that, you know, and that, I think, really, using, again, the reclaimed barnwood, you know, a lot of the choices we made were very intentional for to create what we talk about sort of a life-enhancing minimalism in design. And it's one of the things that was a priority in the design of the space was not to have this kind of opulence, this lavishness, because that's really not what Miraval is about. Miraval is such a personal experience, and it's not someone else's definition of luxury. It's what we want out of our experience, and especially I think in the spa, we wanted that to reflect kind of what our values were for your Miraval experiences. My joke was that when people expect a new spa, they expect these water fountains with these dolphins and or just golden dolphins or who knows.
Oh my gosh, that would so not fit at Miraval.
It would not.
That's that's more like an entertainment center, a circus thing. That is so not what I would want out there.
We're much more sort of
relaxed,
a little bit,
down to earth,
and try to be authentic and not not aspire to be something that that we're not. And I think that those values are really what tie into, I think, what the Miraval experience is as a whole. It's not this aspirational kind of experience, but it's authentic, and it's so we tried to keep the design that sort of simplistic. And I don't know if you've had a chance to ever see any of our villas. Have you seen our villas?
I have seen the villas.
You have,
I've set the intention that I'll be having a villa someday. And I'll have
you're
you
not
over.
Alone.
I'll have you over for some organic wine.
I would love it. Absolutely. I'm your designated house sitter already.
Exactly.
I volunteer for mine. So, the folks that did the design as well as the architecture I mentioned before, Mathun and Clodagh, they designed the villas, and it's very much sort of in that same vein. So, I think you have, that sort of gives you a sense of that very first, looks real, but not too opulent, not too fancy.
Right.
You know, and with a sustainable mindset. So,
what comes to me is like, it's not distracting. It draws you in and makes you be mindful and present. And you're not looking at everything else, which to me are distractions.
Exactly.
You start to feel something instead of, looking at all the decorations.
Yeah. And wanting to be in a quiet space.
Yes.
I mean, that's such an important part of the spa experience. And so in the design, I think you'll see that, there's again, as I mentioned earlier, quiet room is a designated quiet space for reflection and to look at the mountains, which are, obviously our greatest design feature is those wonderful mountains that we look out on. But, I think that that's one of the most important things in design is as you point out so eloquently, when you're distracted and you're looking elsewhere and you sort of visual entertainment takes you away from your focus within. And that's, I think, a huge part of what we sort of go to spas for is to find that quiet place. And, and I think that the design of the environment that we're in, it's such a huge impact. And we've all been in those, been in different places where you just feel off, you don't feel comfortable. And the energy that the design of a space creates has a huge impact on us.
On the experience, totally. And those mountains that you mentioned that are so blessed, They change every 10 minutes. I have been so blessed to live here 37 years, and whether I'm here or at Miraval or at somebody else's house, when it snows, when it rains, when it's cloudy, when the sun hits it in different ways, when the sun comes up, when the sun comes down, there's magic in them, their hills.
Yeah, so true, so true.
Okay, so do you want to talk a little bit at all about your partnership with Clarins, or do you want to keep moving us through the spa? Because it's up to you.
Well, let's do this. Let's talk a little bit about sort of the experience from beginning to end, and then we can talk a little bit about the Clarins relationship, which is a huge part that we're very excited about. And I think that, you know, as we talked about the sort of the energetic experience when you pass through the portal into your treatment area, or you're guided by your therapist and take it into the room. We have these beautiful designed rooms. We've got this just really, really tactily satisfying. I think one of our best things is our new sheets. I just love them to death. They're the softest sheets you'll ever feel. It's so nice. It's one of those little things that that make a big difference.
It really
in the
does.
Sense of the space. Yeah. I think that also the other piece that I think people will really be struck with is as you pass into the area where you experience the treatments, the lighting changes. We have beautiful lighting themes that change as you pass through different hallways. And then we even have light features in the rooms, which are just set this warmth and the tone for the service, which is this very sort of glowy, natural, nurturing space that that we want you to feel as you begin your service. And, you know, one of the things, obviously, that still remains about Miraval is that, you know, our greatest asset is our staff. And so as you pass into this treatment room with this warm glow and this soft sheets that you experience, our staff is still that same nurturing, you know, authentic, present team that really takes such pride in what they do and in nurturing folks and really playing such an important role in people's experience here at Miraval by providing those services. So you experience the touch of some of our you know, skilled providers, and that's one of the things, obviously, that when people write about their experience at Miraval, they generally talk about the highlight of their stay being some interaction they've had with one of our team members that made such a difference in their stay, and I have great pride in my team. So they do such a great job in really communicating the intention of the environment, that authentic, nurturing space that we put you into for your service.
And, you know, one thing that Michael pointed out yesterday, Michael Tompkins, for people that are just listening, the president and general manager, when he did a presentation to our event, he said that there are spa protocols in many spas that you do this at the beginning, you do this in the middle, and you do this at the end. For example, every time you finish a massage, you use a hot wet towel. And he said in Miraval, what you consciously decided is there are unique spa experiences based on what the therapist, the massage therapist, what the staff person and the client agree upon. So it's not, I call that kind of like homogenized, or, you know, it's just like robots. And it's not like that there. I've had the same massage therapist do very different things on me based on what was going on with me when I've gone in there. So I think that's another unique feature of Miraval.
Yeah, and I think that was really also a priority when we began our relationship with Clarins, to ensure that we, you know, that we maintain that integrity. And you know, the way I think of it is that, you know, our team, when people do body work and work in this business, you know, I think of them really more as artisans than technicians, and I think that's sort of what you are.
Awesome. They're creators.
Yes, and I think that when one is too rigid around the structure, the analogy I like to use is that if we're too rigid about how one applies their gifts, we end up with a paint by numbers.
Right.
And
that's not who people are. Yes, that's a great analogy. Right.
Yeah, and we want people to be able to be able to express their gifts and meet people where they are. And so that's a huge priority. You know, we do obviously have some basics that we like everyone to do, such as beginning with an inhalation of a scented oil that really brings people to breath and helps them be in their body. But we really like folks to be able to not just express, I guess, but sort of interpret what someone needs and then tailor the service to that experience. And I think that, I think you're absolutely right. It's the difference between having this kind of homogenized experience versus an authentic one. And that really makes a big difference, I think, in people's experience. And so when we began our partnership with Clarins, they brought a tremendous amount to the relationship in terms of years of spa experience and European spa experience that we really wanted to be able to sort of take the best of what Clarins had to offer and really blend it with what Miraval was all about, which is about that sort of connection.
I know,
and
Simon,
touch.
You hear the music. We've used up almost 20 minutes, and I cannot believe
goodness,
that.
Right.
I know, so we
okay.
have to take a break. If
sure.
you just tuned in, that was Simon Markser from Miraval. He's the spa director of their new spa. He has been there, I think you've been 7 years, is that right?
Oh, just about five.
Five,
about
okay. Five. Thanks for being with us, and I'll see you
Thank
next
you.
Week.
Look forward
can
to
we
it.
Predict
okay.
the future? The reality is we can't, but we can be ready for it. Funded by the National Science Foundation, researchers at the University of Arizona are working on a $3 million project to study the monsoon and learn about our changing desert weather, climate, and ecology. Such knowledge will help guide us to a more sustainable future, not just for our desert, but for the world. Now that's thinking ahead. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Hi, I'm Abbott Taylor. With over 35 years creating jewelry in Tucson, no one has more experience in designing and making diamond jewelry in Tucson than Abbott Taylor Jewelers. Please come in and see some of the thousands of designs we have created, or come in and have us design something original just for you. Whether you're looking for a simple and stylish graduation gift, your engagement ring, or a breathtaking jewelry piece to celebrate an important birthday or anniversary, you can't beat our competitive diamond pricing. With 100% trade-up guaranteed, set in an Abbott Taylor jewelry design, always using earth-friendly recycled gold. Abbott Taylor Jewelers, exquisite jewelry designs and exceptional diamond deals created right here in Tucson for over 35 years. Abbott Taylor Jewelers at 6383 East Grant Road, on Facebook and on the web at atdiamonds.com. Diamond designs for everyone. Abbott Taylor Jewelers.
Hi, this is Mrs. Green with some great news about the all-new 2012 VW Passat. It's 2012 Motor Trend Car of the Year, best in class for legroom, and has standard Bluetooth technology. VW thought of everything by giving the Passat a brand new sleek design that conveys confidence and assertiveness. If you're looking for the best ownership experience possible and a great new Passat, visit Chapman Tucson at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan.
You can always find things around the house to give to Goodwill. But I have a bigger reason to give. My brother, Jim. When Jim was just 6 weeks old, he had a stroke. He had to rewire his brain to do most things we all take for granted. Thanks to Goodwill, Jim has a job and a sense of purpose. You know how they say your donation to Goodwill changes lives? Well, it's true. Goodwill is the best thing that ever happened to Jim. Please donate today.
Grow one. Save a million. Did you know the average shave uses roughly 5 gallons of water? That's why Budweiser and Living Lands and Waters are asking adult men to pledge not to shave for a few weeks to help save 1 million gallons of water for World Environment Day. Head to Budweiser's Facebook page to learn more. Together, we can grow one to save a million. Grab some Buds and take the pledge. World Environment Day is June 5th.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think. We just want you to. Thank you so much for joining us today. And a little shout out. Don't forget that I'm here live every Saturday at noon and also many Tuesdays down to earth with Mrs. Green at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. I've got a great guest this Tuesday coming up. And today, what a wonderful show. I feel so blessed every Saturday when I get to get up and interview passionate, on purpose people from around the country. I know a lot about Simon Markser. He was on for the first piece, and he is really passionate about the environment and about mindfulness and about people's health. He's not just a spa director. There's so nothing glitzy about what they're doing out there. They're really trying to heal people and create life in balance, and it's one of the reasons why I am such a proud partner with them. They're the real deal out at Miraval Resort and Spa. Trust me on that one. And our guest today for the rest of the show is a man that I had the privilege of meeting. His name is Bill DeBuise. He's the author of 7 books. I think I have that right, Bill. And
that's
it's
right.
Like, okay, right there, you're one of my heroes, because I just finished my first book, which you really, now I know, you don't finish your first book, you just finish the first edit, and then it goes out, and then the more work begins. But so 7 books. The one we're going to be talking about today is A Great Aridness, Climate Change, and the Future of the American Southwest. So we are very, very happy that you took the time out of your Saturday to be on this interview so you can share a lot of your expertise and your passion and your commitment to our planet. So why don't we start out with a little bit of background about Bill DeBuise and an overview of how it came to be this book at this time.
Thanks, Gina. Well, first, I want to thank you for having me on the show, and also thank you for having the show, because you're part of the growing network of people who are getting the word out about the challenges that we face in the environment in the United States.
And it can happen fast enough, and there can't be too many of us.
That's absolutely true. I mean, it's a big challenge.
It's a big challenge.
It's very important work that you're involved in. Yeah, about A Great Aridness and my own work, I am actually trained as an environmental historian. Written a couple of environmental histories, one in northern New Mexico, one set in Southern California, and some other things in between. And I was setting out to do a more general environmental history of the entire Southwest. And basically, that effort was hijacked by climate change. The more I got into the project, the more I realized that climate change was going to trump a lot of the historical themes that I had thought were so important. And I'll give you one example of that. I was sitting in a conference in Albuquerque a number of years ago, and a terrific speaker and very fine scientist by the name of Jonathan Overpeck, whom I later interviewed for
yes.
A Great Aridness.
And he's going to be on the show in a couple of weeks.
All right, terrific.
Yes. Yes.
Well, he's one of the stars at the University of Arizona. And he put up on the screen a map of the world, and it wasn't from a study of his. It's from a study by a guy named Chris Milley at a NOAA institution near Princeton, New Jersey.
Okay.
And Chris is somebody else I later interviewed for the book. It was a map of the world showing areas where stream flow, which is to say the water that ultimately is available to humans to use.
Right, right.
People also use groundwater, of course, but surface stream flow is the most important source of fresh water that we tap. It's what fills our rivers and our lakes. He showed a map predicting annual runoff at mid-century, this century.
Right.
And I looked at it, and I was just basically terrified. The map's a good first-order illustration of one of the primary rules of climate change, which is that wet places will get wetter and dry places will get drier.
Right.
And I saw the Southwest. You know, red was drier, blue was wetter, and I saw the Southwest burning red in this map. And something else, I also saw the Mediterranean basin and the Middle East running from Israel to Afghanistan, red, red, red.
Big red hot zones.
That's right. And
yep.
Think about the tensions in the Middle East, for instance. Think about the strains there from the eastern end of the Mediterranean all the way to the Hindu Kush. And you realize, oh my gosh, if you tighten down with the screws of drought on an already really unsettled, challenged region, Right. How much worse can things get? Well, they can get a lot worse.
They can get a lot worse. And just a little interjection. I've had Robert Glennon on the show quite a while ago, and I remember it like it was yesterday when he said, well, the wars of the future will be fought over water. And I was right in the beginning of the Mrs. Green journey, and I was like, I said, Robert, what? And then he went on with many, many examples of water rights being bought up so that they're owned by companies and by private, you know, industry, so that they have water in our lifetime, not in 100 years. So, yeah, it's so real to me. And I think when you said, you know, you were, what did you say, that you were horrified or terrified?
Yeah.
That when it comes to water, that is a word for me. And so, yeah, so keep going.
Well, I, as I say, I looked at this map, and I'll tell you, I felt cold in that moment when I realized what that map was telling me. And I can still remember the ugly pattern on the back of the hotel chair in front of me. as I kind of lowered my gaze and just stared and thought about this and realized that the implications of that map and the origins of that map were two stories I really needed to follow. And that's where my plans for the book really began shifting. And in the end, I realized that climate change was such a big story that if I was going to write about the future of the Southwest, I need to write about the future of the Southwest in terms of climate change, because the Southwest is really in the crosshairs for a couple of interesting reasons. One is that we're already water-stressed, and the other is that with heat and dryness increasing, we're going to trip a lot of fairly delicate thresholds in our ecosystems. Because the Southwest is already such a so poised at the limits of survival,
right,
ecologically.
A delicate balance. So when you started to reframe and come up with another concept for the book instead of the environmental history, how in God's name did you begin to focus on what you were going to write about as content for the book? Give us a couple of highlights for areas, since everybody listening has not read the book.
Well, I realized water would be a big story. Forests and forest fire would be a big story. I would look at rangelands and their sustainability and that delicate sort of argument that goes on constantly between grass and woody shrubs in our rangelands. I would look at the fault lines of society, realizing that the strains of drought and aridity would kind of shudder society and that there would be movement along the existing fault lines in society. And one of those fault lines is the international border between the United States and Mexico. So there's a chapter on the border in there. There's another chapter on wildlife. And these impacts are going to have big, big influences on the future.
Wildlife. And some of what you've written about has already happened. I mean, we had one of the biggest wildfires in the country ever last summer. And as people who listen to me regularly know, our cabin in Greer was destroyed. And we're blessed because we have a primary home. But the devastation of that area, I mean, Bill, it just ripped through. And it devastated.
I know.
It was 560,000 acres. And that's a lot that in our lifetime, you talk about wildlife, all of the things you're talking about, it was terrifying. So that's one. There you go.
Yeah, and these things are going on about us all the time.
Right. They're started here already this summer.
I think of the book as a kind of program. You know, you go to a football game and you get a program so you know the names of the players,
right,
for the numbers and things like that. Where you go to a concert and you have a program that tells you about the music you're about to hear. I think of my book as a kind of program for the game of the century, which
right,
is the transformation of the region under a shifting climate.
What I just want to kind of, to me, your book is not really, it's not the target. I'd like to know who your target audience was, because to me, I read a lot of books. I don't read them all because I don't read them to completion because I'm reading so many things. But to me, your book told stories for me, who I'm not a scientist and I'm not an environmental historian, and it was not dry. You put in stories. I remember one where there's something about a someone from Tucson, and it's I'm being drawn into the story. So when you were writing it, did the fact that it wasn't going to be an environmental historical book, yet, you know, changing the genre, did it change how you wrote it? Does that make sense? That was a long question, but it's
yes,
like...
Yes, I do. I understand the question perfectly. And actually, it didn't... Changing the focus of the book didn't change how I approached it.
Okay.
Or how I tried to write it. But here's my little critique of most environmental writing is that there aren't people in it, and people love to hear about people.
They love stories because they can relate. I agree with
you.
They love stories. Tell me a story.
Good narrative has an arc of action and an arc of character revelation. That's really, you know, if you look at a good novel, that it has it. Really good nonfiction has it, et cetera. And so in telling these stories about the land, and these stories about the scientific investigation of the land, I wanted to do that basically by telling the stories of really interesting people, the scientists who are doing the research, and telling their eureka stories of how they made the discovery, had the flash of understanding how these parts come together and things like that. And to me, those stories are always gripping, and they're also, frankly, inherently optimistic because... they testify to the ability of human beings to understand, to be aware and conscious of their environment, and then to act on that knowledge.
Right, right, right. What about there's a very interesting chapter, where we have about 4 minutes before the break, there's a very interesting chapter about Mount Graham. And I was curious as to how that even got included. And, you know, the chapter is called Mount Graham, The Biopolitics of Change. Can you talk about how that came about a little bit?
Absolutely. Well, From the outset, I wanted to have a chapter in the book that talked about the impact of climate change on wildlife. And the poster child for wildlife being affected by climate change could well be the Mount Graham red squirrel,
right,
which lives at the
right
top of Mount Graham, and its habitat. Its spruce fir habitat is at the top of the mountain and is falling apart or being destroyed by both stand-changing fire and insect infestations, which are the two sort of manifestations of climate change that we're becoming increasingly familiar with.
Is it the bark beetle?
Well, it was bark beetles, it was aphids, it was budworms, it was a whole raft of insect infestations at the top of the mountain.
Because of the lack of water, usually.
Yeah, heat and dryness.
Heat and dryness. Okay.
Stressing the trees, and also with more heat, with a longer growing season, you get more reproductive cycles of insects in a given summer. And so they're just, you know, they're exponentially more of them to attack even healthy trees. So it stacks up to a kind of stacked game against the trees and therefore against the squirrels.
Well, it sounds like... Go ahead.
No, one of the themes of the book is that no big thing happens for just one reason.
Right.
And so climate change is working on the top of Mount Graham, but Mount Graham is also ensnared in a lot of human politics. That's why my friend Peter Warshall calls it the most biopolitical mountain on the continent. And so the chapter is an investigation of those biopolitics as well.
And it's like, really, people, come on. It's like, where's the common intention, which is preservation of the planet? It is. It's a very, very hot topic around here in the Southwest. So, yes, I get that. What I was going to observe is that when you're talking about the squirrel and the cycles of the bugs and, you know, on and on and on, one of the disconnects in from my chair, from where I sit, is the integration of man's connection to that. Because, you know, I want to say, hey, folks, we're all connected. Watch how nature works and integrates with each other and adapts, and we're the ones with the brains. So let's not be late to the party. We've got to
like
be on this party. This environmental things are happening here, and that does affect you. That bark beetle.
Yeah.
So it'll be a flood. I think that we have about a minute, and one of the things that we've got maybe a minute and a half. I'd love to talk to you about your hope for getting people to change. I know that you have a perspective on optimism versus pessimism that we can talk about and what we can do, because I think people sometimes talk to me, I mean, from all around the country, and I don't understand why I'm not the most popular Saturday show at noon. It has nothing to do with my ego. It's the news, the information, the quality of guests like you. And people have said to me, we can only absorb so much information because it really is daunting. I mean, there's so many things that you can look at in my world, and I have to be honest, sometimes it shuts me down. I did a show on fracking recently with Winona Howder from the Food and Water Watch, and like I had to take the day off. So we've got lots to talk about when we come back. We are so blessed to have Bill DeBuise, Arid Lands, A Great Aridness, Climate Change. We'll be right back. Stay here with us.
Go deep underwater without getting wet. Study bugs like a real scientist. Make your shadow move in colors. These are just three reasons to visit the exciting hands-on new exhibits at the Children's Museum Tucson, the region's only museum just for kids. For 25 years, we've ignited kids' imaginations at the Children's Museum Tucson. That's something to celebrate. And admission is only $2 on the first Sunday and on the 25th of each month this whole year. Children's Museum Tucson, where imagination and learning connect.
Hi there, this is Mrs. Green. Did you know that the 2012 VW Beetle has been completely redesigned, that it has exciting new features, look, and performance, and that it is one of Oprah's best things for 2012? The best news is Chapman VW has them in stock. Check out the new Beetle at Chapman VW at 4600 East 22nd Street between Columbus and Swan, or visit them at TucsonVW.com. Be sure to tell them that Mrs. Green sent you.
What if you had simple and easy solutions to live, work, and play green? Green Living Magazine, the premier green lifestyle magazine, brings you the latest in organic cooking, gardening, health and wellness, chef and celebrity interviews, as well as easy solutions to clean up your everyday life. Visit greenlivingaz.com for the latest in green news. Buy your subscription and view our network videos. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, and again at greenlivingaz.com.
Can academic research really save the planet? This year, the University of Arizona took full ownership of Biosphere 2. With five ecosystems enclosed in over 7 million cubic feet of sealed glass, Biosphere 2 is a premier facility for environmental research, where the top minds in the world will come together to address some of humanity's greatest challenges, such as climate change. Now that's using your brains. The University of Arizona. Big questions, bold solutions, better tomorrows.
Grow one, save a million. Did you know the average shave uses roughly 5 gallons of water? That's why Budweiser and Living Lands and Waters are asking adult men to pledge not to shave for a few weeks to help save 1 million gallons of water for World Environment Day. Head to Budweiser's Facebook page to learn more. Together, we can grow one to save a million. Grab some buds and take the pledge. World Environment Day is June 5th.
Welcome back, everybody. You're listening to the Mrs. Green's World Radio Network, where we don't tell you what to think, we just want you to, and we're giving you a lot to think about today with our guest. Right now we have on our line, calling into the studio, Bill DeBuise, who is the author of 7 books. And Bill, if it's okay with you, I'd really just like to take a minute. I wrote about your background on my website, but for listeners that haven't had a chance to look at it, he hasn't just written 7 books. One of them was The River of Traps, New Mexico Mountain Life a New Mexico Mountain Life. And it was a New York Times Notable Book of the Year and a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1991. Enchantment and Exploitation, The Life and Hard Times of a New Mexico Mountain Range, The Walk, prize winners, Salt Dreams, Land and Water in Lowdown, California, Guggenheim Fellow, Active Conservationist. This is the type of guest that I get to interface with on Mrs. Green's World, and it makes me feel very, very blessed. So I wanted to give that to you and say thank you for all that, and then let's keep talking about your book, A Great Aridness, Climate Change, and the Future of the American Southwest.
Well, thanks very much, Gina. I appreciate those kind words. And just before the break, we were talking about pessimism and optimism, and I just wanted to comment, you know, that you pointed out that with all the bad news that's out there, the biggest danger is that people just shut down. It's as though we can only handle
right.
so
and
much
give
bad
up hope.
News before. And I want to say that, you know, in the course of writing A Great Aridness, I had to, you know, live with a lot of this stuff day after day after day. And I realized something about myself, which was that I consider myself to be an intellectual pessimist, but at the risk of making a bad joke, a neurochemical optimist.
That's great. Oh my gosh, I hope I remember to write about that. And if not, I might have to email you because I don't have time to write it down now.
Right. But thank God for serotonin or whatever it is in our in our brain chemistry that keeps us going. The way it comes down to me is that the outlook may be grim, but the sunrise is beautiful. And the sunrise is always beautiful. And if you think about this blessed planet that we're on, which Carl Sagan described as something along the lines of as a mote of dust floating on a sunbeam, which, you know, from the perspective of deep space,
that's what we
all
are.
All this little thing
yes.
is.
Yes.
It is so beautiful. It is heartbreakingly beautiful, and there is so much beauty in the planet itself and in its creatures, and among its creatures are human beings and our fellow human beings and so forth, that there is always and there will always be beauty to protect and defend. And the defense of beauty is a very high calling, and it's great work, and great work is inherently optimistic. And so as long as there's that work to do, I think we should all feel inspired to do it and all derive a lot of meaning for our lives from the act of doing it.
And just tell me what it is again, intellectual pessimist and what kind of optimist?
And neurochemical optimist.
Neurochemical. Okay, I have to write that down because I think that just nailed me. I get very, very, very sad when I get caught up in my head. But I'm a diehard believer in hope, possibility, and change, and in the power of human beings to get engaged, to move us forward. And I have to live with that because yeah. I get up and I am, you know, tweeting, Facebooking, blogging, doing everything I can to help make the connections with the people on the planet to this greater future that I see and hope for all of us.
Right.
So okay, that's a great way to frame it.
We're all working in our various ways toward a whole range of tipping points. We don't know when they're going to come. We don't know when we're going to get there. But think about Václav Havel in Czechoslovakia struggling for freedom. He didn't know when the Soviet Union was going to collapse.
Right, right.
But one day it began to crumble, and before you could turn around, it was gone.
Yes.
It happened so fast.
In our lifetime.
Can happen.
I know, in our lifetime.
Yeah.
The Dalai Lama talks about that. I thought it was funny. I watched him on Piers Morgan, and I thought it was great that the Dalai Lama was going to be on Piers Morgan, so of course I had to watch it. And he was asked if, by Piers, do you think that the world is in better shape in terms of war and all of these atrocities than it was something like that than when you became the Dalai Lama? And he goes, oh, much better, much better. And I was like, really, dude? And he was talking about things like that, you know, the Iron Curtain. Our generation, my kids won't even know what that is.
Yeah.
And the Berlin Wall, like, what was that? So yeah, you're right. So go ahead. I want to talk more about the book, and I get excited about the philosophy of my bipolarness, the intellectual pessimist and the neurochemical optimist.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, Ed Abbey, bless his heart, always said, you know, keep fighting the environmental fight, but don't forget to go out and have fun. Bag
right,
a peak,
right.
Go down a river, you know,
yeah.
Camp in the desert, whatever. You've got to do that. You got to keep your inspiration stoked.
You do. Okay, so what else do you want to tell us about the book?
Well, golly, you know, the basic message is that the Southwest, already hot and dry, is going to get hotter and drier. And the key thing, one of the key things to understand is that even if precipitation stays steady, but you don't want to bet your house on that because it's probably
right.
going to decline.
Right.
But even if precipitation stays steady, things still get drier because with increasing heat, there is also increasing evaporation. So effectively, there will be less water available for people to do things with.
And if you drive around this state, which is quite beautiful, I know that you love and appreciate the desert beauty, there's areas that are just devastating already. I mean, you just see the water levels falling and the reservoirs falling. And my husband and I went out through Saguaro National Monument the other day just to go out and see the saguaros in bloom. And I said to him, this almost makes me sad. It's so dry, and it's only the beginning of May. I mean, it is so dry. It's some of the saguaros had ripples that I have never seen them. They're so water deprived.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just, you don't have to be a scientist, just an observer of nature to literally see some of the changes that are you know, constantly evolving.
Well, what we can expect generally in the region is a downshift. So that, well, people don't say that the Sahara is experiencing drought.
Right.
You know, the Sahara is dry by nature, not by
right.
exception.
Right.
And drought is something exceptional. What the models are telling us about the Southwest is that we're moving into a period when the norm, the new normal, is going to be what the droughts of the past were. And that there will be droughts then superimposed on that new normal. So that what we can expect to be more or less normal in the Southwest will be like the drought of 1998 to 2003, or like the drought of the 1950s or the 1930s. It's going to be a very different region.
It's going to be very challenging. I would love you to talk a little bit about, I think it's the last chapter in your book, because I don't even know if I can say all of it. When I read around, is it Hawiku? Welcome to
Hawiku, yeah.
Hawiku. Welcome. And I'm like, okay, well, that just sounds like a perfect last chapter for a book. What is this? But it made me want to read it. So even in writing a book now that I have myself, not in any way, shape, or form comparing it to this book, is the challenge of the beginning, middle, and end, and the sequence of the chapters. So tell us about how you came this to be the last one and the meaning behind that.
Well, it was intuitive as much as rational, but I sensed that I wanted to bring the book to a close at Hawiku, which I find to be a really powerful place. Hawiku is today a ruins of a former Pueblo village, part of the Zuni Nation in west-central New Mexico. And it was there that Francisco Vázquez de Coronado first encountered the natives of New Mexico and fought a battle there in 1548. From the standpoint that history begins when the written record begins to accumulate, history began for the Southwest, written history, began at Hawiku in 1548. That was the beginning of a new era for the Southwest. And I used Hawiku then, describing the events of 1548, and through the eyes partly of my friend Edward Wimatewa of Zuni Pueblo, Hawiku stood as metaphor for the position we're in today as we enter a new epoch in the Southwest. Now, the changing climate is taking us from the old geological epoch, the Holocene, and bringing us into a new geological epoch, the Anthropocene. the human-shaped epic. And so that's why I chose Hawiku and its long distances, its shimmering light, its eerie, windy silence.
That's scary. I mean, it is, but it's a really, it is a great metaphor for what we, well, maybe it's really like a Back to the Future. Here it is. You know what, Bill, this is what I want to know. Do you think that, what it would be your call to action to everybody that listens to this show or reads your book or downloads the podcast? What do you want to tell people that they can do to feel better and to know better is to do better? So what should they do? What should the average person do? It's as simple as like not wasting water. But in the big picture, there are days when I say, who are you kidding, Gina? What good is that going to do?
Right, I agree. I mean, lifestyle choices, driving an efficient car, not wasting water, all those are good things, and we need to do them. But we can't find success in facing this big challenge unless we do things at the macro scale. And honestly, what we really need in the United States is a carbon tax phased in over a period of time, paying dividends back to the citizens who have to pay the final cost of it, et cetera. But that kind of economic goad would lead to a restructuring of our energy diet in this country. And our country has to lead the world, because of our size and our power and so forth, in achieving worldwide change economically. So we have to work at every level. And we have to work both at mitigation, which is the prevention of greenhouse gas pollution, and at adaptation, because there's already so much change in the system. We've got to work at the local level to make our communities more resilient for the changes that are coming, no matter what we do at the macro level.
Well, I will tell you that I have asked that question of many, many people, and I so appreciate and respect your answer. And I don't say that lightly. I could not agree with you more. There are things that we don't want to stop doing as citizens that will make a difference in the quality of the earth, in our, you know, cutting down on the consumption of plastic bags and bottles, and all of those things do have a ripple effect, but we need the big tidal wave at the leadership level. I couldn't agree with you more. And I always go around to presentations at the university waiting for the next greatest nanotechnology advancement in solar that could be widely applied and make solar affordable, you know, within the next 5 years for every household, whether you were in the Southwest or not. So I do see a lot of young brains working almost feverishly to come up with solutions because they get it. But I couldn't agree with you more. And I got a pit in my stomach when you said that, a knot in my stomach, because when you put it in the political arena, I don't understand why it polarizes people. It's the one thing that could unite our country to focus on the health of the planet and the health of the earth. There's no downside to that, and it's not political. It's survival.
Absolutely.
It's
absolutely.
Like, why are you fighting about this?
There are a host of tragedies entwined with the climate change problem. But one of those tragedies is that somehow climate change has been swept into our so-called culture wars.
Has
become a matter of personal identity and sort of ideological choice. And that is perhaps the most harmful thing in the entire mix.
And it's probably not the majority of people. I spoke at this group yesterday, Greater Tucson Leadership, and this woman came up to me. She said, I'm very conservative, I'm very Christian, I'm very right-wing, and I agree with everything you said about climate change. I don't understand why that gets put in any conversation of politics. And I hear that all the time. So I said, well, you're living consciously, and I agree. It isn't a political issue.
Yeah.
I mean, it shouldn't be. Let's just put it that way. So how do people get a copy of your book?
Well, I hopefully through a vigorous independent bookseller near you, but it's also, of course, available through Amazon and Barnes and Noble's on the web. It's out there, chugging along, and it exists also in an e-reader form if you like to read on a Kindle or a Nook or whatever, you can download it for that machine.
Well, I have the hard copy, so I could write on it. And thank you for that local shout-out. There are copies at the University of Arizona bookstore. That's one that I know, and I don't know if it's at Antigone's, but I do know that you're an incredible guest, that you're making an incredible difference for the planet, and I thank you so much for taking your time to be on the show. And I hope our paths cross lots and plenty in the future.
Oh, I do, too.
Thanks.
It's been a great
so
pleasure.
Much, really so much. Next week, on Tuesday night, we have Jim DeGroot from Pima Association of Governments. Talk about the great things they're doing in transportation. And Rob Parsons from my trip to Hawaii, Wailuku, Hawaii, talking about all the things they've done. And we'll be hearing from our buddies at the Sea of Green. Happy Mother's Day. Make it a great green week. And blessings to all of you for being part of Mrs. Green's world. I am so grateful.